From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
Add echo to somebody's voice and it usually means they're going mad, they're going crazy, or they're going back in time and something weird is happening.
We'll explore the effects of echo and reverb today as we look at the relationships between sound and technology. Also, it looks like the ukulele is making a comeback.
I have a bad habit of driving and playing my ukulele at the same time. My tour schedule is online if you care to know when to stay off the highway.
And the musical legacy of the master violin maker, Antonio Stradivari.
I don't think there's any other real walk of life where the achievements of one man still 200 years after he died are still so supreme.
We think sounds are about the best way of communicating there is. Now sit back and listen.
So if you're a musician or producer, how do you make your music stand out from the crowd? Well, one way is to use exotic instruments that produce unusual sounds. The Beach Boys used one on their hit Good Vibrations. That eerie, electronic, wavering sound in the song was produced by an electrotheremin. Mark Brend is the author of Strange Sounds, Offbeat Instruments, and Sonic Experiments in Pop. One of the unusual instruments Brend writes about is the Ond Martineau. It was invented by Maurice Martineau, a cellist who served as a radio operator during World War I. He created the first instrument that bears his name in 1928. As Mark Brend told Anne Strangechamps, Martineau wanted to create an instrument similar to the theremin.
To play a tune on it is incredibly hard, and Martineau wanted to do something that had a similar type of sound but was easier to control. So he designed this instrument that you could control in two ways, one of which was with a conventional piano-style keyboard, and the other of which was something that he called a ribbon controller, which was a little sliding ribbon with a ring in the middle of it, and you put your index finger in the ring and moved your index finger up and down in front of the keyboard, the piano keyboard. So when your middle finger was adjacent to the C note, for example, on the piano keyboard, it would sound a C note. And it enabled you to slide between notes, get the glissando effect that the theremin is so famous for, but in a much more controlled way so that you could pitch it more accurately, you could play tunes in it, and you wouldn't just make weird noises.
It must be very challenging for a musician, because isn't it like playing a piano and a stringed instrument at the same time?
Yes, it is. I should point out that with the Martineau, you can only use one of the controllers at a time. So you can either use the keyboard or the ribbon controller. But it does have a lot of similarities with a stringed instrument in that it's very touch sensitive. And so that, as well as having the controllers, it has a number of kind of tone type of controls that you can use. And say, like with the violin, the velocity with which you hit the strings, for example, will affect the sound. It's the same with the Martineau. The actual way that you touch the various controls, how hard you touch them and how fast you move your hands will affect the quality of the sound. So it, for an electronic instrument, it's very unusual in that respect.
The alternative rock band Radiohead has used the Ond Martineau, haven't they?
Yes, they have. To my knowledge, they're pretty much the only established rock band that have used one. That Johnny Greenwood, their guitarist, found a very late model in Paris, and he was fascinated by it, and they've used it on quite a few of their recordings, Pyramid Song being one of the most famous. But when they play live, they don't take the Martineau out on the road with them because it's too fragile, and he's worried that it will get damaged, so they've got a kind of custom-built synthesizer to replicate the sounds on stage.
There's one of their songs in particular, Motion Picture Soundtrack. How do you think
Yes.
the Ond Martineau contributes to their sound in that particular song?
Well, it has this type of sound that is a bit, you kind of listen to it and you think, am I listening to an electronic sound or am I listening to treated human voices? And I always think that it's a particularly good instrument for them because Johnny Greenwood plays it in a way that it quite often harmonizes with Tom York's voice. And it's quite hard to distinguish the two. His voice and the Martineau blend very, very well and share a lot of kind of ethereal characteristics in a way.
Let's talk about some of the other more obscure instruments that you found out about. The clavulin, for instance, what's that?
The clavulin, yes, you see, the French were very good at coming up with these things in the earlier part of the 20th century. The clavulin is a little tiny 3-octave electronic keyboard that came with its own integral amplifier. And it was designed in 1947 in France, but mass-produced in the United States and in England, and so was sold on a very, but pretty widely. They were made in their tens of thousands and were very popular. In a way, it's a bit like the Ons Martineau, but in a much simpler form. It only has a keyboard. It has a number of buttons that you can press in combinations to get a variety of sounds. And it's monophonic. You can only play one note at a time. It's most famously heard on two records that were hits in the early 60s. In a modified form, it's on Del Shannon's Runaway. A guy called Max Crook, who was Del Shannon's keyboard player, had a clavulin that he modified and named the Musitron. And that is the instrument that you hear on that Del Shannon record. And then again, Telstar by the Tornadoes, a massive hit in 1962, and the first British rock record to top the American charts. The lead line on that is played on the clavulin as well.
I know Telstar was a huge hit at the time, and expresses a lot that you find really characteristic of the period. Tell me about Telstar and what you like so much about it and what the clavulin contributes to it.
Well, Telstar was largely the work of its producer, Joe Meek, who wrote the song. And although he wasn't a musician himself, he is responsible for the character of the record and the sounds. And I think it's just something that sums up that kind of period of technology. He was fascinated by the space race and going to the moon and all of that type of thing. And in the late 50s and early 60s, there was a great sense that technology would change our lives completely, and there were all sorts of ideas of what the future world might look like. And in many ways, those ideas, when you look back on them now, are quite quaint, you know, that we would all live on the moon in pods or something like that. But there's something about Telstar that sums up that kind of optimistic looking to the future. And I think the clavulin has just got that kind of primitive electronic sound that at the time was very new. You have to bear in mind that electronic instruments barely existed at the time and they'd been rarely heard in public. And so the sound would have been very kind of strikingly unusual to most people who heard it. And that for me all kind of works together in a great package. It's a record that's of its time and sums up its time. But we can look back on it now and still enjoy it, even though in one sense it's very dated.
We have to talk just a minute about the guy who wrote that song, Joe Meek. Mm. You mentioned because he's got to be one of the most colourful characters in your book.
He was a very colourful man. I mean, as I said, he wasn't a musician. He was actually tone deaf, but he loved music and he was very keen on gadgets, electronic gadgets. And he worked as a producer and a sound engineer and built a lot of his own effects, his reverb and echo effects and what have you. He was very secretive about them. But his records, like Telstar and others, had a very distinctive sound that were entirely his responsibility. It didn't really matter what artists he worked with. His records always had his stamp on them. But he was very secretive. And as time went on, that secretiveness turned into paranoia. And he came to believe that people were bugging his studio and that the Beatles were spying on him and that Phil Spector was trying to steal his ideas.
Well, he also had a strong interest in the spiritual and the occult, didn't he?
He did, very much so. He particularly had an view that Buddy Holly was speaking to him from beyond the grave and was dictating hit records to him. And
maybe he did.
You never know, because he had quite a few hit records. But Joe Meek's story, for all its kind of fascination, ended tragically in that he killed his landlady, shot her, and then shot himself on the anniversary of Buddy Holly's death, I might add.
Let's talk some about drum machines, because, I mean, these days they're very common, but that wasn't always the case. We're talking about the period of time when, as you said, there were no other electronic instruments. This was all brand new. Mm. When did the first drum machines come out?
Well, there were, in tiny numbers, drum machines were built by a man called Harry Chamberlain from the late 40s onwards. But they started to become popular, or they started to be manufactured in bigger numbers, I should say, in the early 60s. Various Japanese manufacturers started to make them. But even then, they were incredibly limited, and they didn't sound anything like drums. They tended to be used for two purposes, one of which was to accompany organists. You know, a home organist would use a drum machine as a means of keeping time. And also, guitarists used them as just something to practice to, so they could keep rhythm. But it wasn't really until the late 60s, when drum machines had been around for getting on for a decade, that musicians actually started to use them in pop and rock records. But even at that stage, they sounded nothing like a drum kit. They sounded percussive and they sounded rhythmic, but you couldn't say that, for example, a drum machine snare drum sounded anything like a real snare drum. But like the clavulin, it had its own distinctive sound that had some appeal. And a number of musicians started to exploit this to great effect, really.
Didn't Sly and the Family Stone kind of popularise them?
Family Affair was a huge hit, a massive international hit. And it showed people that drum machines could be used with a lot of expression, because people criticised them for saying that they were too rigid and there was no dynamic flavour in them. And yet Family Affair is a record with a great groove, a great feel to it, and it's based entirely on a drum machine pattern. There are no live drums in it at all.
It's a family affair.
It's a family affair.
Of the drum machine have any larger effect on the development of pop music?
I think they did. I think Sly Stone in particular, because, you know, drum machines are very popular in all sorts of soul and R&B and rap and hip-hop music now. And that's music that tends to place a lot of emphasis on groove and feel and rhythm. And I think Sly Stone, not only with Family Affair, but with other hits, showed that that was possible. And the drum machine is a completely integral instrument in pop music now. Most artists and musicians and bands use drum machines, even apparently conventional guitar groups, say a group like U2 will use drum machines. So it's been completely absorbed into the mainstream of pop music. And I think people like Sly Stone paved the way, showed that that was possible.
Hmm. Well, you're also a musician yourself, and you put together a group called the Strange Sounds Orchestra.
That's right, yes.
Yeah, and you've got some songs on the CD that comes with your book. What about Omnichord Theme? Tell me about that one.
A lot of the instruments I've become interested in were designed as a way to make music accessible. And the Omnichord is one of those things, in that it's something that you play simply by pressing buttons, really. You press chord buttons. It has some of the characteristics of an accordion, where you have chord buttons, but it's electronic. So it has a little built-in drum machine, it has chord buttons, and it also has, well, the harp part of the Omnichord is a kind of what they call a strum plate, and you run a plectrum along it and it makes a sound like a harp. A very curious thing. And the little bit of Omnichord music on the CD is made entirely with one Omnichord, just played off straight.
That's amazing. And what about your other song, A Strange Sense of Liberty?
That has probably about 20 instruments on it. There's a rhythm ace drum machine, one of the first drum machines, a clavulin, a jew's harp, a mountain dulcimer, a ukulele banjo, various Casios, a stylophone, which was a toy instrument that David Bowie used. So lots of instruments all on that track.
That's Mark Brend and the Strange Sounds Orchestra with A Strange Sense of Liberty. Brend is the author of Strange Sounds, Offbeat Instruments and Sonic Experiments in Pop. He spoke with Anne Strangechamps. Peter Doyle is the author of Echo and Reverb, Fabricating Space in Popular Music Recording 1900 to 1960. Doyle's book is the first history of acoustically imagined space in popular music recording. He talked to Steve Paulson about the history of echo and reverb, starting with an explanation of the difference between them.
They're the same physical phenomenon. Echo is
the single
bounce
of the sound.
You shout out into the canyon and you hear the same shout come back to you, distinct and discreet. Whereas reverb or reverberation is that kind of washy, messed up piling on of echoes so that it's just a general kind of tail on the sound, if you like.
Well, let's talk about some of the songs that you have written about, starting with Robert Johnson's 1936 recording, Come On In My Kitchen. How does Robert Johnson use echo and reverb in this song, Come On In My Kitchen?
It's way out of its time, that record. It's about how cruel the world is, and he's sort of offering this little kind of refuge, come on in my kitchen, it's going to be raining outdoors. And then he does this little interlude where he says, hear the wind howl, and does a little slide guitar lick. And then he mutters, you know, he really mutters, it's at such low amplitude that the mic hardly picks it up, really. It wasn't really correct for the technology of 1936 or whatever, just recording in a hotel room, but he mutters as though he's got the technology we're used to. Baby, can you hear the wind howl, or whatever the exact words are. And he does this sort of thing like an almost, I think it's like an oral, a sonic close-up. You know, he's kind of really zeroing in and he plays this really kind of very delicate lick on the guitar. Then you hear his bottleneck sort of accidentally bumps against the fretboard of the guitar. There seems to be so much going on in that. It's like he's aware of his audience there and saying, come a little bit closer, you know, just zone in a little bit more on this. There's all the sort of legends about Johnson, how he, when he recorded that in a hotel room in San Antonio, Texas, you know, just a makeshift studio, for reasons that are much argued about, but no one really knows, he faced into the corner of the room as he did that, whether it was shyness or a sense of privacy about his guitar playing technique or whatever. One of the theories is that it was a little acoustic engineering technique so that the sound would sort of bounce off the walls right in front of him. Use the reverberation from the walls just to kind of boost his sound a little bit. You know, we really don't know, but there seems to be such an intensity in that moment, in every sense of the word, a kind of intensity in the meaning of the song. He draws his listeners into a kind of more intense engagement with the record. Yeah, that kind of concentration into the corner there.
Well, and the effect is something very haunting. And, I mean, the thing that they say about Robert Johnson is, you know, he somehow evoked some part of him, some part of his soul that was extraordinary. I mean, you rarely hear it, and you hear it in this song.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I guess what I'm interested in that is how really materially he does that, because we feel that. The first time I ever heard that when I was a teenager was that moment of the song, you know, and wow, I've just never heard anything like that. And it's, you know, it's fascinated me ever since. There are real things he's doing. It's not just magic. It's deliberate.
You better come on in my kitchen, cause it's going to be raining outdoors.
Now, a very different use of echo and reverb comes later with a song like Rosemary Clooney's Hey There, a 1954 recording, where she actually uses this technology to evoke the inner thoughts of someone.
Yeah, there's a few sort of things like that from the time, from the late 40s, early 50s, where female pop singers, they were recording onto tape then, so it was pretty easy to double, triple, quadruple track and re-record and sing back with yourself and all that sort of thing. So they started sort of multiplying women's voices and started splitting it up so that one voice would be the conscious self and the other one is the conscience or whatever. And so there's numerous examples from the time, but they'd often put the secondary voice, also give it a kind of big echoey, reverby kind of embellishment to make it more like it's coming from the depths of the soul or something like that.
Well, and you create the sense of multiple personalities. I mean, you have kind of the authentic voice or the voice that everyone kind of associates with in normal life. And then you have this kind of otherworldly, almost sort of movie quality voice that is kind of mysterious and inward looking.
Yes, that's exactly right.
Hey there, you with the stars in your eyes.
Are you talking to me?
Love never made a fool of you.
Not until now.
You used to be too wise.
Yes, I was once.
Let's talk about another big pop hit. I think another 1950s song, Les Paul and Mary Ford's How High the Moon, which was, I think, a million-selling song.
Yeah, it's a funny thing. It was a million-selling song. In that little period after World War II and before the coming of rock and roll, record sales were generally not great. The pop music industry sort of was in a slump after the war, which it remained in until the coming of rock and roll. But the few records that sold really spectacularly, you know, in the US and throughout the world, often were semi-novelty or tricked-up kind of records, and Les Paul and Mary Ford, How High the Moon, was one of them. You know, it was so unlike its contemporaries in how careful and sophisticated it was with multi-tracking and the use of echo and counterpointing dry on-mic sounds with off-mic sounds. It's a tour de force of technological manipulation.
So is that what it is? Does the credit go to the technical wizards behind the scene as opposed to just the people, you know, the singers?
How High the Moon by Les Paul and Mary Ford really rocks. It's got a fabulous drive to it. That's, to me, when the effect really happens. It's working with just fabulous playing, and it's got the really lovely bell-like guitar sounds from Les Paul, the kind of sound he was so good at. Some people might even find it almost too clean by the kind of modern, more distorted standards of guitar sound that we're used to. Paul used a very, very clean, ringing sort of tone, but that with the kind of really nice driving rhythm guitar that Mary Ford played, actually. It's kind of simple, and the reverb and echo effects just kind of make all these snaps and crackles and pops happen all over the thing. And it's kind of tricksy, but it works.
Until you will, I still my heart.
Now, there's another song that you write about that has assumed a kind of a legendary status in the history of rock and roll, and that's Elvis Presley's Mystery Train, which was his last single he did for Sun Records in 1955. What is so significant about the echo and reverb that he's using there?
That's one where questions of the space and place and movement and mobility, you know, the whole song is about that. The archaeology of the use of echo and reverb on recordings. You know, it goes back to a sort of a setting up of a fake space in a way. So when you add reverb, add echo, you're kind of imputing physical dimensions that may or may not be there.
Are you talking about evoking the sound of the train in the background with that guitar?
In Mystery Train, the guitar has this sort of slapback echo effect on it that Scotty Moore played. It's just a very simple but exquisitely catchy lick people still are fascinated by. But then there's this other weird stuff happening where it's a song that uses verses, free-floating verses. A lot of them have been around for decades and decades in other sort of folk tunes songs. But it's got no coherent spatiality to it in a way. He's on the train. He's waiting for the train to arrive. He's seeing it coming around the bend. He's seeing it leaving. You know, what's going on here? Where's he? Where are we? What space is this coming from? And, you know, there's no answer to that. There is no single coherent spatial regime there. And I think that's really kind of what started happening with rock and roll. There's so much new that was ushered in by Elvis Presley and all the other people, rock and roll and rhythm and blues of the mid-50s and early 50s. But one of the things that they really did do, I think, they used a lot of these technological sort of tricks and techniques that were around, already available, but they were under no compunction to make sense, to be coherent, to sort of paint a picture. So it was just a sort of disordered, kind of anarchistic sort of space that was proposed. And I think Presley really did that. And I think if you listen back to the recordings, that really is happening. You know, it's not just hype about early 50s rock and roll. There is really something materially there that's going on. It's traceable.
Woo!
Peter Doyle is the author of Echo and Reverb, Fabricating Space in Popular Music Recording 1900 to 1960. He spoke with Steve Paulson. If you have questions or comments about this program, we'd love to hear from you. You can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. Coming up, the stories behind some of the greatest musical instruments ever created, Antonio Stradivari's violins, as we continue to focus our attention on sound. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Classical music may not be as popular as it once was, yet chances are that everybody still knows what a Stradivari is, one of a thousand stringed instruments that the master craftsman Antonio Stradivari made during the late 1600s and early 1700s. Approximately 600 of these treasured instruments survive. Toby Faber writes about six of them in his book Stradivari's Genius, five violins, one cello, and three centuries of enduring perfection.
I began my story, well, with the Messiah violin, really. I mean, most of these violins are named after famous previous owners. That's not the case, obviously, for the Messiah violin, which was not owned by the Messiah. Rather, it is famous, and it's still the most famous violin in the world, really, because it is perfectly preserved. Its varnish, in particular, still looks exactly as it did when it first came out from Stradivari's workshop. And even in the middle of the 19th century, that made it unique. And when an Italian violin dealer came to Paris to boast that he had this amazing, perfectly preserved Stradivari back home in Milan, nobody believed him, but he carried on boasting, and they got more and more exasperated with him, until eventually one person said to him, "This violin of yours, it is like the Messiah, always expected and never appears." So that's how it got its name. Well, anyway, it did eventually appear, and that the story of its appearance really made it the most famous violin in the world.
One of the stories associated with it is that no owner has ever been able to give it up during his or her lifetime. It's not quite true, but it's an indication of the way in which this instrument has grabbed hold of people's attention, isn't it?
I think that's right, and I think people who really care about violin making just love to look at this violin. In fact, I think it's not as beautiful as many other Stradivari's, because part of what makes a violin beautiful is the way the varnish has aged on the back of the violin. And it doesn't have that. But people who know about making violins just go into raptures about it. On the other hand, I think anybody who plays a violin, and this is one violin that's hardly ever been played, but performers develop that kind of link with all their violins, I think. It's such a partnership that they can't bear to part with the instrument.
Now, how is it that this one is so perfectly preserved?
I think it's happenstance, really. If you look at the sort of first 100 years of its life, it seems to have been inherited by one of Stradivari's sons, who inherited a number of instruments. It's just this was one of the last ones that he then sold on. He settled on to a nobleman who was a collector rather than a player. And then that collector passed it on to another collector. And then by the time we reached the middle of the 19th century, that made it pretty much unique, but never having been played. And from then on, nobody was going to play it, because it was the last example left of an unused Strad.
One of the other things that is consistent throughout all of the stories you've told is that the players talk about the communication with the instrument, how they feel as though the music that has been performed on it by previous performers is there for them to draw out. That would almost argue that the Messiah is less valuable because there is so little music being added to it over the years, if you believe their theory.
It's certainly true, I think, that a violin won't sound good until it's been played for a while. And players do talk about detecting when they play a violin or a cello, the previous player. They can somehow detect their tone and their sound in the violin as they play it, which is understandable, I suppose, because to a certain extent, violins do contribute to the sound of a player. As for whether or not they store these memories of previous performances, well, it would be nice to believe that was true.
Well, especially when you consider that some of these instruments have been played and owned by some of the great violinists of history. Menuhin, for instance, owned the Kevenhuller, one of the the strads that you write about.
Yes, and what I love about that violin, although Menuhin was a very spiritual violinist, of course, and he certainly was conscious, as he played the Kevenhuller, of the spirits that were in it from previous players. One of those previous players, for example, was the man who led the first successful performances of Beethoven's late quartets in the 1820s. I love the idea of this violin, which Menuhin played before the Second World War, really at his peak, also being played 100 years before in some of the most important performances, really, of any on any violin.
How well are these instruments documented? Are you able, for instance, to be able to track the development of his skill through the course of his years? Did the violins get better and better as he went along?
You can certainly do that, yes. Really, he was born around 1644, and his first violins he started to make around in the mid-1660s. And they're very well carved, but not particularly good in terms of their, as violins, well, I mean, they're still pretty good, better than anything being made today, but still, they're not necessarily his best violins by any stretch of the imagination. You can see him getting better throughout, all the way through to the 1680s, and then the 1690s, really experimenting with the form of the violin, trying to get this greater tone that he wanted from his instruments. And he ended up succeeding around 1700. And from 1700 to 1720 is what we call his golden period, when he produced the famous violins that are the most valued today and are the ones that people still try to copy today, really.
What kind of changes did he make in his instruments in order
to... He experimented a lot with the shape of the violin when you see it face on, in terms of making it longer and narrower. And those violins from the 1690s are called the long strads. In fact, that didn't really succeed, but at the same time, he was experimenting with the shape of the violin viewed side on. A Stradivarius, by comparison with what went before, is much flatter viewed side on than the relatively bulbous violins that went before. And that basically delivers more in terms of amplification area in the sound box of the violin, and that's what gives the violins the greater power. Although Stradivari was making them at a time when people didn't really need it. By the 19th century, when people were playing in large concert halls, they found they really needed that greater power in their violins. And then, as I say, he lived a long time. His violins for the last 15 years of his life are still very good, but they are his hand is starting to get a bit shakier, so you can see the sound holes are carved slightly less neatly and that sort of thing.
One of the instruments that you write about is not a violin, but a cello, and it is not necessarily a logical step for him to make. Yes, they're both stringed instruments, and yes, they are played often together, but there's a big difference in size and in what you're trying to accomplish between making a violin and making a cello. Did he bring the same skill to the cello that he brought to the smaller instrument?
He did. It's very interesting, actually, because you can see the early cellos of Stradivari, and also everybody went before him, are much larger than modern cellos. And he obviously started to worry about this in the same way as he was worrying about the tone of violins. And for a few years, once he perfected the form of the violin, he didn't make any cellos at all. Then he went back to making cellos and produced basically the form that we now know of as the modern cello. And his cellos are every bit as valuable and sought after as his violins, if not more so, because they're rarer. Making a cello takes a lot more effort than making a violin, and he made many, many fewer.
One of those instruments is the one you write about, the Davidoff, and it is associated with two of the great cellists of the 20th century, Jacqueline Dupré and Yo-Yo Ma. The curious thing, in a way, is that while you extol the virtues of this instrument, neither Dupré nor Ma seems to have found it an instrument to be favored.
That is the curious thing, I agree. I think in Jacqueline Dupré's case, she did produce some of her greatest music, some of her greatest recordings, playing the instrument. She never seemed entirely comfortable with it, and people now think perhaps she would have been better with a Montagnana, who Domenico Montagnana made cellos in Venice a little bit after Stradivari, because she was such an emotional, emphatic player. She liked to feel that the more you put into an instrument, the more you get out. Stradivari's, you have to play, you have to draw the sound out, really, in a slightly more subtle way. I think Yo-Yo Ma loves the Davidoff, but he also has a Montagnana, which he also loves too. The Davidoff is set up now. He set it up for Baroque playing. So when he plays Baroque music, he plays it on the Davidoff.
There does seem to be an emotional attachment to the Davidoff for Yo-Yo Ma, because in fact he borrowed it from Dupre, didn't he?
He did. I mean, obviously, for the last 15 years of her life, Dupre wasn't really able to play her cello with her multiple sclerosis, and for a long time it sat unused in a storeroom or a Parisian violin dealer until Yo-Yo Ma was allowed first to try it and then to borrow it. And he's described the process as like opening up a really great wine. The sound just kept on coming and coming.
He talks about coaxing the sound out of that instrument.
That's right. And that comes back to what I was saying about that's the way you need to treat strads, really. You need to treat them more gently than some of the other. Treat them right, and they'll treat you right, I think is the phrase.
Why is it, do you think, that no one has been able to make an instrument to match the Stradivari? Certainly there have been artists, there have been musicians, there have been scientists who have devoted much attention to it. Is there really such a difference? I mean, does it come down to art and magic?
You can't totally discount art and magic, I think, but I'm a rationalist at heart, and I search hard for rational explanations. The point is that we need to come back to, I think, is that violins and cellos do need this period of aging before they really reach their full potential. It's not the full 200 or 300 years, but it's 50 or 100 years. And if we look back at the violins that were being made 50 or 100 years ago, like Vuillaume's, for example, we can see the mistakes that he was making, if you like. Modern violin makers certainly aren't making those mistakes. They may be making other ones. But I do think it's quite conceivable that the violins that are being made today will, after 50 or 100 years, sound as good as Strad's. I might even go further and say that modern violin makers have a whole set of other advantages that Stradivarius never had in terms of the knowledge of the physics of the violins, acoustics, material science. And I'm sure the best of them is not, they're not just trying to copy Stradivarius. They're trying to use modern technology as well to help them. I'd like to think that in 50, 100 years, it won't be the case, as it still is at the moment, that when a soloist steps on a stage, more often than not, they'll be playing instead of Arias.
It does make you realize, though, that if it takes 50 to 100 years for an instrument to achieve its potential, Stradivari never knew that his own were as good as they are.
You're absolutely right. I mean, so much has changed in the world of violin playing since he was making instruments, not just their aging, but the bow has changed, the tension the strings are under has changed, the type of strings has changed. It's entirely clear to me that whatever he heard, it's very different from what we hear now. And it just shows what good anticipation he had of our current needs when he was making these violins so many years ago.
Toby Faber is the author of Stradivari's Genius, 5 violins, 1 cello, and 3 centuries of enduring perfection. Coming up, singer-songwriter Victoria Vox talks about her new album. It features an instrument we haven't heard much from lately, the ukulele. As we conclude our Hour on Sound, I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
National support for To the Best of Our Knowledge is provided by Powell's Books, an independent bookseller since 1971, offering used and new books, collectible editions, staff recommendations, and unabridged reviews. On the web at powells.com.
Tiptoe through the wind.
Visions of Tiny Tim tiptoeing through the tulips in the late 1960s. That is probably what comes to mind when you think of the ukulele. Turns out that the ukulele is making a comeback in popular music. As To the Best of Our Knowledge producer and senior ukulele correspondent Doug Gordon discovered.
Darling, you've got to let me know. Well, should I stay or should I go? Well, if I say that you are mine, I'll love you till at least 9:30. So come on, let me know. should I stay or should I go?
That's the Ukulele Orchestra of Great Britain with their interpretation of the Clash song, Should I Stay or Should I Go? This group is doing its part to bring the ukulele back into pop music, and so is Victoria Vox. Vox's new album is called Her Jumping Flea, and the title comes from the very definition of the Hawaiian word ukulele, as Vox explains.
Uku is flea, and lele means jumping. And I was like, yeah, Victoria Vox and her jumping flea!
If you like a ukulele lady, ukulele lady like a you. If you like to linger where it's shady, ukulele lady linger too. If you kiss a ukulele lady while you promise ever to be true, and she sees another ukulele lady fool around with you.
Her Jumping Flea is Victoria Vox's fifth album, but it's her first to feature the ukulele.
I discovered the ukulele, ukulele, as it's properly pronounced, about 2.5 years ago. There's a version of Somewhere Over the Rainbow, What a Wonderful World. That version of it with the two songs melded is done by Israel Kamaka Vivo Ole. We just call him Iz, because it's much easier to say. But I heard his version, and it almost brought me to tears the first time I heard it, and I adapted it to guitar, not really knowing that it was a ukulele. And then a friend of mine heard me play it, and he happened to have a ukulele collection that I didn't know about, and gave me one of his ukuleles to play.
Originally from Algoma, Wisconsin, near Green Bay. She now lives in Baltimore. Vox earned a degree in songwriting from the Berklee College of Music in Boston. She spent her junior year of high school as a foreign exchange student in France. That's where she bought her first guitar. It's also where she discovered Le Vent Nous Portera. It's a song by a French band that Vox covers on her ukulele album.
That song is actually a Noir Désir song. They're a great independent band from France. This song came out a couple of years ago, and it was one that I heard on the radio since going back to France. And it's called Le Vent Nous Portera, which means the wind will carry us. Just the groove of the song, the original groove, and I enjoy singing in French, and I also do French concerts at universities and high schools. But I'm like, this would sound really cool on the ukulele.
Je n'ai pas peur de la route, faudrait voir.
Vox also offers a ukulele-fied interpretation of the Talking Heads song, Cycle Killer.
I wanted something that was a little bit more edgy, that people would recognize but not necessarily expect on a ukulele. And so I just was looking through my CD collection, and so I'm going through boxes and boxes of all my jewel cases of, you know, what could I do, you know, Britney, you know, not that I have Britney Spears, but I'm thinking, you know, Britney Spears, or should I do a Madonna song? Maybe a Cyndi Lauper song. I'm a huge fan of Cyndi Lauper. And eventually came across Talking Heads, and I was thinking, like, oh, Psycho Killer. And then I'm like, no, everyone knows that song. And then I was thinking maybe doing, like, Burning Down the House or, you know, something different. But then as I was listening to the album with Psycho Killer, because of the French bridge, I knew immediately, I'm like, this is it. You know, this would really tie in the French thing with the Le Vent Nous Portera song.
I can't seem to face up to the facts. Tense and nervous and I can't relax. Can't sleep, my bed's on fire. Don't touch me, I'm a real
One of the most beautiful songs on the album is a Victoria Vaux original called America.
Actually, I wrote the entire song behind the wheel of my car. I have a bad habit of driving and playing my ukulele at the same time. My tour schedule is online if you care to know when to stay off the highway. And I started in a traffic jam outside of Pittsburgh, and we weren't going anywhere. People were turning their cars off, playing soccer, frisbee on the side of the road. And I thought, well, you know, I'm not going anywhere. I was looking to write new songs for the ukulele album. And also had a lot of emails that I needed to catch up on. I'm like, well, I'll get my computer and the ukulele out of the trunk and we'll just see what happens. And after being harassed by the RV next to me to play Tiptoe Through the Tulips, it was such a shame because it was a beautiful day out, but I had to roll up the windows because they wouldn't leave me alone. And I just kind of started playing this 6/8 feel. Eventually, the traffic started. We kind of were going at 5 miles an hour, and then all of a sudden, I'm going 80, and I'm still playing the ukulele. It's actually quite a spiritual song for me, and that it's about me touring and having the support of people who are at the shows, but also it's that I'm doing this because I kind of joke and sometimes say, what else am I going to do? I have nothing better to do. It's a search for happiness and that feeling whole and getting to know myself. So it's kind of like people are supporting my music, which is indirectly supporting me finding myself. To me, it's a happy feeling, and people just light up when I play it, and it is easy to listen to. And I think with this album, I didn't want it to be anything too far out there. I wanted anybody, whether you're 4 years old to 100, to be able to put it on and be just like, it's a nice listen.
One of Vaux's fans describes her as a cross between Jewel, Miles Davis, and Dawn Ho. Sounds pretty good to me. Last December, Vaux played 10 shows in the heart of ukulele country, Hawaii.
While I was there, I also got picked up by Ko'aloha Ukulele. They're based out of Honolulu, and they're Hawaiian family who makes handmade ukuleles. I'm now sponsored by them, And so they gave me a $1,500 ukulele for free. And it's beautiful. It looks like a pineapple. It's their pineapple sundae model. And to have them really come out and say, we love what you're doing, we believe in this, and you're bringing the ukulele to a new level of a more commercial pop sound. They didn't see it as an insult, which reassured me, because it was something definitely that I had thought about going over there. Here, I'm from Wisconsin, I'm going to Hawaii, and I'm playing a ukulele. I'm not a ukulele player. So my publicist and friend Stoli, we handled the tour more of I'm a singer-songwriter, and this album happens to be on the ukulele, and it's the new medium for my songwriting.
Victoria Vox, with a song called My Darlin' Beau from her ukulele album, Her Jumping Flea. She spoke with, to the best of our knowledge, producer Doug Gordon. If you're interested in finding out more about Victoria Vox, you can find a link to her website on our website, ttbook.org. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like a copy of this hour, you can call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444 and ask for program number 723A, Hooked on Sonics. If you have questions or comments about the program, you can send us email through our website at www.ttbook.org. It's always nice to hear from you. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This program was produced by Doug Gordon, with help from Mary Lou Finnegan, Anne Strainchamps, Charles Monroe Kane, and Veronica Rickert. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Thanks to engineer Brad Kohlberg. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
Public Radio International.